Hi folks, it's Ray. In our conversation and interview casts, we'll be talking to some incredibly interesting people. We'll hear stories of how people saw a vision, followed their dream, battled through adversity, and achieved success. We'll also hear some very practical insights on subjects such as human resources, compliance, recruitment, health and safety, and general well-being. We encourage you to get in touch. You can email the show at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. We welcome your feedback, and we hope you enjoy the show. It's just so incredible. Gotta have it, can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know that this is incredible. Now have you ever wondered how the best did it? They never second guessed, they didn't set limits. Are you a follower? A visionary, can you handle the load that you were meant to carry? Cause we're on a mission, listen, it's beyond description. We don't want to fit in if we're living in a contradiction. We need a brand of passion that you can't imagine. Don't hesitate, rub the lamp. Welcome to Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast. Today we've got with us Andrew Munn from Lunatus Resourcing. Hello, Andrew.
Hello there.
Good to have you here.
No, thanks for having me here, it's a pleasure.
Andrew, tell us a little bit about your professional background and how you got into resourcing and recruitment.
Well, it's an interesting one with that. Sorry, Ray. I mean, basically, when you speak to a lot of recruiters, they will certainly say that they never had an aspiration to be a recruiter. It was something they fell into, albeit the industry they're in. I guess my pathway was a bit of an interesting one, really. I went to university to do performance studies, an acting degree, of all things. But I took on the sort of stage management and directorial side. I took more of that rather than be on the boards itself. So with that, I went and actually got elected to be the president of the university, which was actually dealing with the student union bars, the events side of part of it.
And what uni did you go to?
I went to University of Northampton.
Okay, cool.
So, so that's something I rather enjoyed doing. Then with that, I was looking at the hospitality side and I joined a UK activity tour operator to create the activity packages for them. So that was like negotiating the hotels, activity sites, spas to create the packages. Something we get today is like the spa packages and dinners all included. I was one that used to coordinate those. And then, like you do, you're looking at what can I do next? I walk into an agency and they say, hey, have you ever thought about being a recruitment consultant? I went, not on your life.
Well, you didn't say to them, it's all I've ever dreamed of.
Exactly, no. Funny enough, that is like never a consideration. But what the person said to me, must have been very good at selling, but it was true to the word, was, well, you like working with people. You sort of deal with people on the day to day, and this is kind of what you're going to do. You're going to be finding people for places and get what they are needing. So for the business and people, you're getting a perfect match. That's all it is, as simple as that. Find the people, find the businesses, get them what they want. And I was like, well, actually, I quite like that. So I did it at the beginning with a big company based on hospitality and recruitment. So I was going into events, and at first it was find those people for the events. Then I started finding myself organizing the events for the clients. Reason for it, one of a love, of a passion, if you call it, but more to the point, it was actually, do you know what? These are people that I really want to enjoy what they do. So that was always the mantra I'd done with it, and I've kept that with recruitment. So why am I still doing recruitment? I mean, you know, some people have it with a gold watch. I've been doing it for the best part of 16 years. It's because I actually enjoy what I do, but I get the pleasure of actually working with people and finding people what they want and clients and working with them on a collaborative basis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's something that interests us here at Leaders and Managers Hub in general, that, you know, people say, oh, why is somebody in such and such a role? Actually, you know, because people always look at these things from their perspective and they will come up with a million reasons why they wouldn't want to do that role. But you know what? If you're doing something that you're passionate about and something that you enjoy and something that you're good at, why would you want to do anything else?
Absolutely.
Kind of question.
And don't get me wrong, I've always looked at what could I do as an alternative career, alternative industry. But I've always come back to this. And it is because I'm working with people day to day. And, you know, I'm dealing with the most valuable, but also probably the most unpredictable asset in any business. So for me, it's actually something I think, well, it's a joy. Yeah.
So, Andrew, tell us a little bit about Lunatus Resourcing, where they started, how you got involved, and, you know, some of the work you're doing, some of the clients that you get to interact with.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Lunatus Resourcing, it was the brainchild of a previous colleague of mine, actually. He actually appointed me. We both were working for a logistics business directly, setting up their internal recruitment processes. He brought me on as a contractor. He'd come from Tesco's as in charge of their staffing, and also for Skanska, he went and worked for. And so what he did is, like, he finished a contract earlier than me. So when he was looking around, he was basically saying, I'm sick of working with recruitment agencies, or not working the way that I would like to work with them. Because whether that would be businesses coming to him, or whether it would be, I guess, people looking for work for him. So he set up Lunatus Resourcing on a mantra of how he would want recruitment to be done. Now, he knew about, obviously, my ideologies and how I work and my behaviour of what I believe the culture should be. And he said, look, why don't you come on board? He went in on the HR aspect of recruitment. He knows what I dealt with, which was very much more on a high street level, as you would call it. You know, your catering, your industrial warehousing, driving side. And he said, look, this is an arm that I know you've got real good expertise in. I want you to come on board. So we've gone on that, but we try to work very differently. We like to, you know, it's like, how can we be different? Well, the best part you could put about it is very much about the transparency, the honesty level, you know, making sure everything is honest. And basically, I tell every business we work with exactly how we recruit, exactly what we're going to do. And there's no hidden, like, agendas, or even there's not a magic formula that we won't tell you about. They know exactly how it works. And the reason we do that is you get better buy-in, you get better trust, and more better than not, you actually get actually more longevity, just because they know what they're getting, and actually they come onto your ideals of working, rather than, this is our process, this is how we do it. Oh, that's amazing, I've got no idea what that means, but we'll go with you. We don't go like that. We want to make sure that our client base, if you like, have full understanding of the mechanics of how we work. And that's the mantra that Lunatus do.
Excellent. I kind of personally resonate with people who take a decision that they want to do something a different way, and want to do it in their own style, and want to do it the way they feel that things should be done. Because that's how I ended up creating Campion Project Consultants, because I felt there's just a better way to do it.
Absolutely.
And I felt a little bit dirty by the rail construction industry, because I feel that it lacks a little bit of integrity and honesty, and I wanted to not impose that's the wrong word, but I wanted that to be core to our brand. So I appreciate what you're saying about honesty and professionalism being some of your core values.
Yeah, I mean, what I'd say on that is the recruitment industry as a whole doesn't always have the best of reputations. For whatever reasons.
Oh, we're going to get onto that. Don't worry.
Yeah, don't worry.
Oh,
yeah.
That's coming up.
That can be very justified, you know, for many reasons. But more to the point, though, like you say, there's always a different from the norm. There's always a way to look things differently. But it's about how that is bought in. And I think that's always a key aspect when you look at that.
Yeah, and I would also say, for anybody who's out there who's maybe in a role and thinks that they could do it better and they'd like to work for themselves, but they're a little bit worried about, oh, you know, if I'm trying to book the trend, will people come to me? You can't really worry about that. You've got to have the courage of your convictions. If it's right for you, you're not going to be the only person on the planet who thinks that that's the right way to do it. So if you are courageous enough and you're firm in your beliefs, people will come to you. You've just got to have a little bit of patience about that. Obviously, marketing is quite important. You need to get in touch with the right people. But if you constantly stick to your guns and stick to your beliefs, things will come for you.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, it's the perseverance, and things don't always work the first time. But I think it is making sure that if you keep with that mantra, you keep with the way of, like, this is my mission statement, this is how I'm going to work, this is my ethics. Like you say, people will buy in and engage, and that's the absolute key.
Good. Perfect. So moving swiftly on then, now we're getting into the Jeremy Paxman sort of interrogation style of questioning. This is the Leaders and Managers Hub, the podcast version of this. So in my experience, and my experience is very much from rail construction, I've not seen organizations put enough value into the recruitment and selection process.
No.
And what that looks like is that often it seems to be like a quick and dirty, get me bodies, get me people. And they don't necessarily see the value in terms of getting it right until it goes wrong and becomes an economic issue. First of all, is that fair, and or is that something that's just confined to sort of rail construction, or is it more ubiquitous? And second, if it is fair, why do you think that is?
I would actually say it is quite fair. I think it's quite fair that actually people look at recruitment probably in the wrong way. And what I mean by that, there is an obsession, and more so because it's been derived by marketing, by what is going on in the world at the moment, by people saying there's less skilled people out there, there's less people, it's a bigger sort of fight for getting the right people for organisation, that it becomes almost an obsession to get a position placed, not actually looking at the long term. So when you talk about an economic issue, people don't actually look at the economics that of loss of productivity or loss of training. You know, the cost of that is far more than actually having, can be four times more than actually getting someone in the first place. But no one actually thinks of that, because more often than not, they don't see it on the bottom line. They don't see it in their cost. It's a residual thing that will come at time when you actually realise what you've lost in terms of the productivity that you aimed for the end of a financial year, for example. So companies won't look at that. They will look, first of all, purely at, this is what I need, this is what I need to get it done. And unfortunately, they look at that as too much of a focus, rather than, if I do get that person, get it placed, what will happen? So it is quite fair to say that, you know, this is where people may come out of looking at a bad experience for them, for the job seeker as well, or organisations, because maybe they portray their business, or the job seekers themselves feel they have to portray themselves in what they want to hear. And what then suddenly happens is actually what people really look for now, which isn't necessarily about the pay or the title of the job or what even the job role entails at that point, because that's what people are pulled in by. It's more about actually, what is the culture? What is the environment? What is the leader? What is he about, or they about, or she about? What is the whole plan for the next 5 years? Can I see myself there? Can I, as we always say, can you enjoy going to that place to work?
Mm.
That is never in a consideration normally until post, and sometimes that's too late.
Yeah, and like my experience, again, very much construction-based, is that companies don't see these things as being an issue until it becomes an economic one.
Exactly.
And for me, delivering projects, one of the biggest indicators for me that we're getting something right is if we have a low turnover rate.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also because, you know, if you have a high turnover rate, something's not quite right. But also if you have a high turnover rate, it makes it very difficult to create a team culture within a high-performing team, because every time you have a change out of an individual, you're almost starting from zero in terms of building up that trust and relationship within the team.
Absolutely.
So it's important.
Yeah, the old school mantra used to be like, don't worry, if you don't work out, we'll find someone else. But that's usually a hiring manager and operations mindset. But unfortunately, that isn't the case as much now. But more to the point, as we were saying, you don't actually see the loss and cost it is to a business overall. Because normally, without being derogatory, people that are making those decisions will not be aware or won't be responsible for that overall loss. And I think that's quite a big impact that businesses have.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Andrew, again, and this is based entirely on my own experience, but hey, what else have I got to go on, really? Once we've achieved the recruitment and selection part of the process, whether we've done it effectively or not, let's just, for the benefit of this, pretend that we have. You then have the next part of the process, which is equally as important, which is the onboarding. And again, I've seen quite often that we don't invest enough time or give enough value to this. again, in your experience, what's your experience of that?
You're totally right. I mean, we're in a, you know, the business world moves at such a pace now. And the evolution of it just changing and changing. You know, there's a new evolutionary change as we speak at the moment because of the B word. That's creating things. But the way you got to look at that is very much that because of that, people do the first part, I think I mentioned earlier, that they're obsessed with getting a position filled. But then they don't think about what is the onboarding part of that, what is the part of integration, you know, and how can it, the retention part is not really considered because it's like, why should that be a problem now? We've got the right person. That will never happen again. There's that sort of ideal.
Why on earth would that person ever want to leave us?
Exactly. You know, it's like saying, why do they want to leave us? How, you know, we're fantastic. That was, and quite rightfully, businesses should feel that way in their sorts. But with at the other part of it, they need to consider what is it that does work to maintain that. Now, my experience of this is a few things. I'd say it depends on the leader, the business leader. They're a visionary. You know, what they visualize, what they say they want their business to be, that should go through their whole organization, regardless who is the one that is recruiting, who the person is managed by, for example. That's a key element. The other one I think is always a key part is people will find ideology what they feel is perfect for their business. And I think this is where sometimes there's a mismatch. And this is always a big part of retention. A good example is they say, right, I need this person to do X, Y, and Z. This person's CV can do X, Y, and Z, and a bit more. That person's fantastic. So they bring that person on board. But then what they tend to do is not let them do a bit more. Actually, they try and mould them to how they feel they should be. So what they end up doing is they recruit someone who could be perfect for their organisation, but actually, when they bring them on, they try and mould them how they feel they should be, rather than, actually, we know what you're able to do, go for it. Yeah, I use the sort of always an analogy of football, if you excuse this one. There's two different types of management you tend to find. There's a manager that will say, what are you good at doing? You're good at scoring goals? You just go and do that. You're good at defending? You do that. That's because that's what you're great at. And then you've got another manager say, right, we're a big collective here. This is what your job is in the collective. Do not deviate from this. But when people recruit, they don't look at it like that. They look at it, it's like, right, okay, you're great at scoring goals. But then they come in and said, no, you've got to track back. And this is what the difference is you don't let people do what you've actually hired them for. And people that go into business or go into a company to work, they tend to find that happens after 3 months, after 6 months. And then they realise, do you know what, I'm not actually doing what I was actually hired to do or what I believed I would be hired to do. And this is where there's a big problem with it. So this is why retention has got to be considered on at the very beginning. Who are you hiring and do they fit that culture? Do they fit what the ethos of what their job will be to do in the business? Because if that matches and it is exactly as it is on the tin, they will do it and they will stay on.
So I guess what we're saying there is that because the next question is to do with turnover and how debilitating and stuff staff turnover can be. But you've kind of already addressed that insofar as we need to consider it as an end to end process.
Absolutely.
So we need to define what it is we want the person to do and what attributes and skills and everything else that the prospective candidates must have. We should be very clear about the process of how we're going to recruit and select, and we should give adequate value and time to that process.
Absolutely.
And at the point where we make the appointment, we should have at least for the first 6 months, a clear program in place about how that person is going to come into the business, how they're going to be settled in, what their initial tasks are going to be, how we're going to measure their performance, how we're going to path their career. Because I guess for me, you got to, when you're recruiting somebody, yes, you're recruiting them for a role, but ideally you're looking at somebody who can go as far as they possibly can within the business. And an investment is not just for Christmas, it's for life in terms of resource. You want people who can grow with your business and challenge your business to grow. I'm not sure that if we, the way we currently do things, I say we, there are great examples out there, I'm sure, but the way I quite often see that we do it is, it's almost, as you said, let's get over the first hurdle of recruiting for a position. Then we'll worry about the onboarding. You know, when they turn up on day one, we'll then worry about getting them a desk to sit at and some IT to work with and that sort of thing. And then we'll worry about how we're going to keep them engaged and how we're going to invest in them to grow with the business.
Yeah, there's very much that thing of an entrepreneurial spirit where that happens a lot. Where it's like, let's get the person in and let's work it out later, is the old good term. And that does happen a lot, unfortunately, in businesses where actually I've got a great person here, this can be a great asset for the business, but they haven't actually really thought about what their journey will be and actually just thought the recruitment part, let's get that done, exactly what you say, but then they don't look at what is the next phase. And really, they should be looking at least not just the first 6 months, they should be looking at a 3-year plan. Because that's where really, if you're a business, you look at a three-year stint of where do you want the business to be, and then you work your way back from that 3 years.
Hmm.
You should do that with your employees, certainly.
Do you think it's a little bit more prevalent in an SME? So, say for example, somebody's had a gem of an idea, they've set up their own company, it's their baby. On the balance, do they tend to struggle a little bit more than larger organisations where the recruitment power is devolved more, slightly more?
They do and they don't. I mean, every business, SME, work very differently that I've experienced. You've got some that are very much, when I talk about entrepreneurial, or let people fly and spread their wings, that they can allow it because they've got that fluidity to be quite organic as well. They might have an end goal, but they know that they don't have to go in a straight line to get there.
Hmm.
The other side of it you do get, though, is if someone is an SME and they've been master and commander, for example, but yet they don't want to, learn, they find it hard to understand a new technique that comes in from an outside source. So with that, their buy-in as the business leader is a lot harder because an SME, you know, the risks are greater if something doesn't work out. So with that, sometimes taking that calculated risk, if they don't understand it, is something they're not wanting to bring on board. So sometimes that autonomy isn't there for someone new that comes in.
Yeah, and I think as well, I'm not entirely sure that we legislatively make things very easy. So what I mean by that is, I recently took on a part-time employee, and this person is classed as a young person under the law.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are some obligations that I have to meet and some requirements that I have to meet because of that as an employer. But they're not actually, because of the nature of the business I do, the risks are very low. So it's a very easy process. But I could actually imagine that it might actually put companies off a little bit to do that. And also, again, with disabilities as well, that companies might feel a little bit nervous because they don't necessarily understand fully what their obligations are. And so it's this big thing of, well, if I take on somebody with a disability, potentially I'm going to fall foul of the law and, you know, it's going to be a big problem. So they will do whatever they need to do to almost sort of avoid that thing, when in truth they could be missing out on somebody who will take that business to places it could never imagine it could go.
Absolutely, yeah, and that happens a lot, but that's down to actual awareness of the situation, awareness of the people, awareness of new techniques, new industry methods. And it could be, like I say, if you've always worked in a way that's always worked for you, then that's fine. But as we said, business is changing at an unbelievably fast rate. And so somebody that comes in new, that's hard for someone to maybe input or take him on board. And so when something like that happens, yeah, there are lost opportunities. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's something that we maybe need to have a little bit more courage with, and again, maybe legislative bodies could invest a little bit more in creating that awareness and making that information more available to people. And again, you know, obviously recruiters and, you know, resourcing companies and consultants are all over that as well. So maybe as SMEs, we should seek a little bit more advice rather than just sitting there frozen with terror. Actually reach out and ask, what are the implications?
Absolutely.
What do I need to do? Because you guys are the experts, right?
The information's out there, and there are, like I say, industry experts. And, you know, if you go and ask them, they will answer. Like I said before, you know, there's nothing really to hide. There's not a magic formula that should be kept locked away. A lot of it is actually, this is practical sense. This is how it can work. And it works really, you know, there is a psychology element to it, absolutely. But again, that is something that shouldn't be hidden. Actually, people are quite subconsciously aware of it. They've just not got it in their forward conscience. But sometimes, like you say, speaking to an industry expert, they go, oh, do you know what? I knew that all along. I just never really put it into practice.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So if any of our listeners have any thoughts on anything that we've discussed so far, please get in touch at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. Andrew, in a recent talk that you gave here at Basepoint in Folkestone, you talked about trends in with modern job seekers and the way companies approach recruitment and selection and the way job seekers approach recruitment and selection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to give you an overview, I stepped away from what I'd call mainstream recruitment to go do some contract work. And the luxury of that is I had many internal recruiters doing the do for me. When I come back to with Lenatus, I found it fascinating, actually, the psychology now of how people job hunt, but what impact that has on a sort of a social level in terms of like how people do it psychologically, and how they do that now. It's very much that they use the way of job hunting the same as they would be as an online consumer. And I found because of the use of technology and the use of smartphones that people will engage using smartphone technology and expect the same results as they would if they were buying something online. So with that, it's like, yes, you know, a lot of companies use technology now to recruit, but have they actually really thought about the psychology of what is that person, the job seeker, thinking? What is their mindset of what they feel that transaction should be? And it's very different to what people really assume. So I did a presentation on that basis.
So just to for the benefit of some of our listeners who are maybe like me, children of the 70s, and technology isn't our strongest boot. So we're talking here about almost people applying for jobs a bit like they do with online dating, for example. So sort of like swipe right if you're interested, swipe left if you're not.
You could go with that. I mean, the way it looks now with the smartphone technology, what job boards particularly realised was we need this to be very accessible. Now, there's an impression at the moment that there are less skilled people out there, or that there's more skilled jobs, so there's less people, the pool of people is less. They also find actually since 2019, being in 2019, the amount of vacancies in the UK is reducing. Now, this is problematic. So, especially if you're a job boards, for example, not to say that it's just on them, but why they looked at it was like, we need to give more accessibility. We need it to be more of an ease because one, people that are paying for job boards or advertising, they will want results. So what are the results? Applications. People that are looking for work, what do they want? They want accessibility to a number of jobs that are available. And this is what smartphone technology has done. Because every year it's gone up by 10% in terms of people that apply on smartphone rather than your other mediums like using a laptop, for example, or a PC, or even on a newspaper advertisement or the good old-fashioned phone-in or walk-in with a paper-based CV. People will use these online platforms. So using a smartphone is, for most people, is in their hand for at least 6 hours of a day being active. If anything more, over 90%, I believe it's 96% of people own a smartphone. If they have a mobile phone, it's a smartphone device. And so you can understand why that's growing. So what would that mean? Well, in a basic way, is the job boards will look and say, how can we make this as smooth as possible and as quick as possible? So yeah, what one of the steps they will use is quick applying. Or you would just type in, for example, say, signalling technician in Dartford area or for Ashford area, and you get a list of jobs within a radius of that. What it also probably is, you put under GDPR, obviously, what you allow, maybe email address, as simple as that, as your own sort of signing in sign. What that instantly creates then is they can capture and target you with other options. Have you considered this? Like you kind of do with certain online store cards. If you buy certain goods, suddenly you get an email from that company saying, we saw you bought this the other day. Have you considered this?
People who looked at this product also looked at this product.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly the same process they do with job hunting. So what people will do then is like, oh, okay. They'll look at it, but maybe what they'll do is they'll skim read. So what they'll do, they'll look at the title. If there's a salary or package in there, they'll look at that quickly. They'll probably look at keywords that they recognise in there and then quick apply. So some people, now whether you think this is good or not, may apply for up to 10 jobs within 3 minutes because they can. And that's a big difference. Now, it causes a different problem, but also for the person that's a job hunter, if they do make an application, regardless of the size of the position, they'll expect a response. And the speed of that response is something which employers sometimes are hard to grasp in terms of how quickly they respond to someone that's applying. Because the expectation now of a job hunter is to get a response within 24 hours. If you do 48 hours, that seems a long time now.
And in that time, they've lost interest, moved on, etc., etc.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, that is the sort of mantra they'll have now. They would go to the point of, they may have an automated email, perhaps, at best, saying, thank you for application, we'll be in touch, if they will be. But they'd still expect the next stage of the process to be within 48 hours. And if they don't have that, they've moved on. Mm. As I say, they could have applied for another dozen jobs in that time.
And just on that, like if you're applying for, if you're skim reading and you're looking basically on job title or salary band or whatever, and you get people who've maybe applied for 10 roles in the space of like a couple of minutes when they're on their lunch break or something, like how many of those jobs realistically are those people interested in? And like a follow-up question to that is, how many of these job seekers are bona fide, genuine job seekers?
That's a very good question. I mean, when they looked at statistics of this, they say about 36% are actively looking.
Right, so literally just over a third.
Exactly. Ones are actively looking. Passive job hunters are much higher, near about 49%. Now, passive job hunters, best way to put it, they're actually quite happy where they are, but they're quite interested to see what's out there. So they're not really committal or really actively needing to move, but they will just have a look, and so they'll apply just out of interest. But that 49%, if they find the right job, could be interested to have a discussion. Frighteningly, though, there is the remainder percentage that apply but have got no intention whatsoever. I think they just do it just for the sake of it. I don't know whether that, again, this goes beyond my thinking. Maybe it's a social media phenomenon, how you like things or how you want to like associate to be seen that you are active with something. So a lot of people, you know, actually apply for jobs with no intention whatsoever of having ever wanting to go forward with it.
I'll give you a hypothesis on that because I know somebody, I'm not going to name them, obviously. I know somebody who applied for quite a senior person in an organization, applied for a job at an equivalent level with another organization because he wanted to feel if he was successful with going through the process and getting offered the job. He didn't actually want it, but he needed it as an ego boost. He needed it as a reassurance for himself that actually he was desired, if you like.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a very similar. That was a very.
I can tell you that was a very interesting conversation we had over dinner, because I was like, I had a million questions about what's going on there with your psychology.
Yeah.
That would cause you to do that, but I guess like organizations need to consider that when they've got a number of roles they've got to recruit, and so therefore, you know, you have data sets that say, right, I need to have so many applications to be able to boil it down to this number. Those sort of rogue applicants, if you like, can really skew the numbers a little bit, you know, and could cause you a lot of problems.
And it's becoming more and more relevant. It's happening more and more. I worked for an organization where I had to get 45 applications to get one person because of the conversion rates that were going on. That was very extreme. But what you have to take in consideration, there is a bit of a science to it, and also a bit of a conversions that you have to go from. Right, how many applications will I need to get to that one ideal person, if it is just for one person? And you have to go with that as well, because realistically, you can actually say, this is how many applications I want. And if you do that, then you will get it. It can be as simplistic as that. You'll have to pay for that to whatever level it will be. But if you get to that level of knowing that, I know if I get this amount of applications, I'll get that person, then fantastic. Obviously, there's not an exact science to that.
Yep.
But if you can work to that as a trend, then yeah, you're not going wrong.
Well, I guess it sort of allows you as somebody who's in the nuts and bolts of the day-to-day of getting people engaged into organizations, you need to understand that, because you need to understand the level of effort that's required to be able to fulfill an assignment, I guess.
This is it. And on my part, as you could call it, I'm a service provider. You know, people come to me for a service not because they need me to fill that position. As what I've said at the beginning, it's very much about that we're finding someone that's an investment to your business. And by doing that, it is the business transaction shouldn't just be thinking about a recruitment agency to the company. It is actually the company work with a person as also a business meeting or mm-hmm. an investment. Because at the end of the day, as we've talked about, retention, productivity, that person being right for the culture and that workplace is absolute key. So for me to work with that, then the companies need to understand what actually goes on. Not just about, this is what I want, this is how many people I want to interview, and this is when we'll do it. It's actually understanding, well, is that fit for purpose? And if a company is willing to consult with that, then we can get the happy medium. Sometimes there are where companies do lose out is because it always used to be a feeling that, well, there's more jobs than people. Or sorry, there's less jobs than people, a better way of putting
yes.
it. And so with that, it was actually like, well, you know, they haven't got any other options. So we will put the parameters in. You will come at this date. We'll contact you at this point. You will do this process with us. And then by that point, it might have worked in the past. However, nowadays, if you went with that person, you've lost their engagement and they've gone. But what I will state on all of this is the speed and responsiveness doesn't mean you have to make a decisive measure there and then. But it is about getting the engagement started. That's key. Whether you want them to go through hoops in terms of recruitment process after that, well, if you get them to that stage, it's because you've got that first initial engagement right. And then you can do whatever you wish, whether it's psychometric testing, whether you want them to do any sort of trialing or any sort. That bit is your part of your onboarding, as far as I'm concerned, as much as a recruitment process.
Yeah.
But the real key part is that initial part, which people seem to lose track on, especially businesses, that people don't wait around.
Yeah. Yeah, we're very much a society of we want it and we want it now.
Exactly.
And we're not prepared to wait. And I guess as well, you know, you make that initial engagement back to the applicant, you very quickly then realise whether they're genuinely interested or whether they're just kicking your tyres or whatever.
Exactly. And that is a great barometer to do it by. You know, if someone applies, you have the capabilities to apply as soon as you see that application nowadays, and it doesn't take much effort. But by doing that, you're showing a two-way engagement there straight away. If they then respond to that, then you know you've got a true application. Mm. And then with that, you can then start the dialogue. And then you can make that decision, which is the power back in, to make sure, is this the right person to continue this journey with?
Mm-hmm. And I guess as well, sort of maybe a slightly off that track, but still equally important, for organizations for whom their culture is important, and at Leaders and Managers Hub, you know, we hope that culture is important to all organizations. When you engage with a recruiter to go and do that initial recruitment, you need to consider that if you want to portray your organization's culture and its beliefs and core values, you need to work with a recruiter who is able to embody that on your behalf, because potentially they're the first contact that a potential employee has with your organization. And so it shouldn't just be a race to the bottom and all about, you know, cheapest is best. It's about sitting down and understanding the ethics and making sure that the recruitment organization understands your culture and philosophy.
It's absolute key. You know, it's not about the how expensive it will be or trying to nail it to the lowest price. It's about value. And I think that's one of the biggest differentiations people don't think of. People believe, you know, I'll say this outright about recruitment, is to get the best value out of recruitment doesn't necessarily mean being the cheapest. If you can be competitive, that's different, but don't take what is the cheapest option. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that actually can happen at times with companies. So the way to look at it is actually, if you are going to be using a recruitment agency, I would say certainly the best thing you need to think of, are they in line with what we are believing? Are they in line with our culture, our beliefs? Are they the ones, because they're going to be spreading the message, looking for those ideal people for us, but do they understand what we are about? They're not going to over egg it. They're not going to like floss over things. They're not going to hide things. They shouldn't. Transparency is the key. If you get a recruiter that can be as transparent to the people about the businesses that they're representing, you're more on for a winner. It's very much when you get someone that comes in front of you and you think, I had no idea this is what the business was about, you know you're in trouble. Or actually, that wasn't discussed with me. So I also say that is a two-way thing. So the business needs to be quite open with the recruiters. But to do that, there's got to be a two-way trust.
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed a change in the last, in my industry, probably within the last 5 years. And I believe it's a change for the good, in that when you conduct interviews as the hiring manager, it's now starting to turn into a two-way interview. And I kind of like that. You know, I want people to come into the interview with an expectation and a demand. And I want to make sure that the person that we choose and we hire, you know, is coming to us because they see something in us as an organization that will benefit them as much as we see something in them as an employee that will benefit us. Because for the longer term relationship there, you need to have that two-way thing. And I do think that it's actually a generational thing. Maybe back in my generation, you know, we were encouraged to leave school, get a career, find a partner, buy a house, have children, retire after 40 years with your carriage clock, you know, hunky-dory, great. And I think the younger generations want more than that. And I'm actually quite enthusiastic by that, because what you get with those people as well is if you get the match right, you've potentially got somebody who can grow with your business as far as you can reasonably go. And also you have somebody who has the ability to drive that business as well. And I'm talking about, you know, people who come in at all levels, because if you recruit into any particular level in your organization, and you're not thinking of them in terms of, A, how can this person drive our growth and how can they grow with us, you're kind of missing a trick a little bit. Now, I know that's not always easy to do, because, you know, sometimes it's more about volume. And we've talked off air about, you know, some of the industries where it's all about numbers, and it maybe it's sort of like a transient workforce or whatever. Yeah. But if you want to make a real investment in your organization, and people are your single biggest investment, and you have a proper sustainability plan, growth plan, resilience plan, you need to make sure the people you're engaging fit into that.
Absolutely.
And that suits them as well. Otherwise, it's going to be an unhappy marriage and it's not going to last long.
Exactly. And the way it is seen now very much is it's not a would-be job seeker going to an interview to see an employer, a would-be employer. It is like a two-way business discussion now because, you know, I use it as a corny start at the beginning where I say, you know, the most valuable asset in any business is the people within it. You know, they can be the most unpredictable, but they are the most valuable. They are, regardless of the amount of technology you might have and processes you will have, you'll still need the right people to run it and drive it. And that's what people know nowadays, is they know that actually I will go there to make sure it's right for me as much as it's a job to get. And that's very how it's very different. And businesses that are very on board with that are the ones that do thrive. They're the ones that actually are very successful now because they realise now, you know, we talk about a younger generation now, there is this sort of a, you could say, a generalistic view that they want things so much quicker and they want things so much easier. The first part I agree with. They do want things quicker, but they'll work just as hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference now, is actually speed of progress, speed of movement is much more what happens in today's society. So people would naturally expect that with business and work.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think we can generalize about these things. No. But my experience of... any generation, if you get proper engagement, two-way engagement in an employer-employee relationship, like the output will be so much more. With machines and technology, yes, we always make sort of step change improvements, but with your human resources, there's no end to where they can go.
Exactly. If you get buy-in, which is the ultimate, you know, we talk about business leaders and we talk about them being the visionary. And you talk about them having what their, I guess you could say, their generals pushing that vision and making it work. But those generals would need to get buy-in from the soldiers to say, oh, I understand how that works. It becomes their own belief as well. That's how it can work. And it has to work in a business culture more so, rather than do this, do as I say. It doesn't work because if they're not actually engaged or actually understand why, you don't get the right productivity.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, we learned this in the construction industry when we, from a health and safety perspective. So over the decades, we, you know, developed and refined systems and processes, safe systems of work, et cetera, et cetera. But we were still killing people at an extreme rate relative to other sectors. And so we started to look at the psychology of people at work and behavioral safety. And we realized that actually, it is about engagement, that you can have any amount of process and any amount of procedure, but at the end of the day, you're relying on people to actually follow those and go above and beyond and you know, use their initiative and do all the things that humans can do that currently machines can't. Now, let's not get into a conversation about AI. But, you know, at the end of the day, humans are adaptable, you know, they're flexible, they can understand, they can assimilate information, they can transform. So we want to encourage that. We don't just want to create human robots. Yeah. And I think organizations need to consider that. Plus, as well, you need leaders at every level of your organization to drive success. The most successful sports teams are teams that have leaders all over the field, as they say. We got leaders all over the pitch. They don't just rely on the coaches and the manager. And so organizations need to think a little bit like that as well. And that's one of the things we're kind of pretty passionate about at Leaders and Managers Hub.
Absolutely, I can see that. And what I'd say is, you know, for companies, if there's something I'd say, what could they do differently to what they do as a norm now? It would certainly be is look at what your recruitment process now. And does it actually think about the person rather than the actual process of hiring? Does it, you know, what are you taking into consideration of, like, when that person applies for your job, are you considering what their next expectation will be? And I think that's something to always really consider when you do your own recruitment, is you've got to look at that and think, right, I'm putting an ad on, or I'm actually putting a poster up on a Telegraph poll, whatever way you want to do it. and you get applications that come in, how are you going to react to that? How are you going to engage? Because that will be the key to your success right at the beginning part.
Wonderful. Andrew, it's been great.
Pleasure. Thank you.
How can our listeners get in touch with you?
So I would say, like, well, I wouldn't say is an old school way, but you can just get in touch with us. Best way for me is my email address, I'd always recommend. So it's andrew@lunatusresourcing.com. That is, yeah, the best form of communication.
Okay. And also, if listeners want to, they can email us at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. And if in the subject line they put a reference to Andrew, we'll make sure that that correspondence gets to Andrew. And one of the things I was discussing with Andrew earlier off air was the possibility that if, you know, we get some good feedback, that we may even in the not too distant future dedicate a whole show to issues around recruitment, selection, onboarding, etc. So any questions you have, any interesting feedback you've got, any interesting experiences you've had, anything you want to challenge us on anything that you've heard in this cast, please get in touch, podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. And we'll catch you soon. I will do my very best. Okay. So, Andrew, again, and this is based entirely on my own experience, but hey, what else have I got to go on, really? But again, in my experience, once we've achieved the recruitment and selection part of the process, whether we've done it effectively or not, let's just, for the mm-hmm. benefit of this, yeah. pretend that we have. You then have the next part of the process, which is equally as important, which is the onboarding. And again, I've seen quite often that we don't invest enough time or give enough value to this. Again, in your experience, what's your experience of that?
You're totally right. I mean, we're in a, you know, the business world moves at such a pace now, and the evolution of it just changing and changing. You know, there's a new evolutionary change as we speak at the moment because of the B word. That's creating things. But the way you got to look at that is very much that because of that, people do the first part. I think I mentioned earlier that they're obsessed with getting a position filled, but then they don't think about what is the onboarding part of that? What is the part of integration? You know, and how can it, the retention part is not really considered because it's like, why should that be a problem now? We've got the right person. That will never happen again. There's that sort of ideal.
Why on earth would that person ever want to leave us?
Exactly. You know, it's like saying, why do they want to leave us? How, you know, we're fantastic. That was, and quite rightfully, businesses should feel that way in their sorts. But with at the other part of it, they need to consider what is it that does work to maintain that. Now, my experience of this is a few things. I'd say it depends on the leader, the business leader. They're a visionary. You know, what they visualize, what they say they want their business to be, that should go through their whole organization, regardless who is the one that is recruiting, who person is managed by, for example. That's a key element. The other one I think is always a key part is people will find ideology what they feel is perfect for their business. And I think this is where sometimes there's a mismatch. And this is always a big part of retention. A good example is they say, right, I need this person to do X, Y, and Z. This person's CV can do X, Y, and Z, and a bit more. That person's fantastic. So they bring that person on board. But then what they tend to do is not let them do a bit more. Actually, they try and mould them to how they feel they should be. So what they end up doing is they recruit someone who could be perfect for their organisation, but actually, when they bring them on, they try and mould them how they feel they should be, rather than, actually, we know what you're able to do, go for it. Yeah, I use the sort of as an analogy of football, if you excuse this one. There's two different types of management you tend to find. There's a manager that will say, what are you good at doing? You're good at scoring goals? You just go and do that. You're good at defending? You do that. That's because that's what you're great at. And then you've got another manager say, right, we're a big collective here. This is what your job is in the collective. Do not deviate from this. But when people recruit, they don't look at it like that. They look at it, it's like, right, okay, you're great at scoring goals. But then they come in and said, no, you've got to track back. And this is what the difference is you don't let people do what you've actually hired them for. And people that go into business or go into a company to work, they tend to find that happens after 3 months, after 6 months. And then they realise, do you know what, I'm not actually doing what I was actually hired to do or what I believed I would be hired to do. And this is where there's a big problem with it. So this is why retention has got to be considered on at the very beginning. Who are you hiring and do they fit that culture? Do they fit what the ethos of what their job will be to do in the business? Because if that matches and it is exactly as it is on the tin, they will do it and they will stay on.
So I guess what we're saying there is that because the next question is to do with turnover and how debilitating and stuff staff turnover can be. But you've kind of already addressed that insofar as we need to consider it as an end-to-end process.
Absolutely.
So we need to define what it is we want the person to do and what attributes and skills and everything else that the prospective candidates must have. We should be very clear about the process of how we're going to recruit and select, and we should give adequate value and time to that process.
Absolutely.
And at the point where we make the appointment, we should have at least for the first 6 months, a clear program in place about how that person is going to come into the business, how they're going to be settled in, what their initial tasks are going to be, how we're going to measure their performance, how we're going to path their career. Because, like, I guess for me, you got to, when you're recruiting somebody, yes, you're recruiting them for a role, but ideally, you're looking at somebody who can go as far as they possibly can within the business. And an investment is not just for Christmas, it's for life in terms of resource. You want people who can grow with your business and challenge your business to grow. And I'm not sure that if we, the way we currently do things, I say we, there are great examples out there, I'm sure. But the way I quite often see that we do it is it's almost, as you said, let's get over the first hurdle of recruiting for a position. Then we'll worry about the onboarding. You know, when they turn up on day one, we'll then worry about getting them a desk to sit at and some IT to work with and that sort of thing. And then we'll worry about how we're going to keep them engaged and how we're going to invest in them to grow with the business.
Yeah, there's very much that thing of an entrepreneurial spirit where that happens a lot, where it's like, let's get the person in and let's work it out later, is the old good term. And that does happen a lot, unfortunately, in businesses where actually I've got a great person here, this can be a great asset for the business, but they haven't actually really thought about what their journey will be and actually just thought the recruitment part, let's get that done, exactly what you say, but then they don't look at what is the next phase. And really, they should be looking at least, not just the first 6 months, they should be looking at a 3-year plan. because that's where really, if you're a business, you look at a three year stint of where do you want the business to be, and then you work your way back from that 3 years. You should do that with your employees, certainly.
Do you think it's a little bit more prevalent in an SME? So say, for example, somebody's had a gem of an idea, they've set up their own company, it's their baby. On the balance, do they tend to struggle a little bit more than larger organisations where the recruitment power is devolved more, slightly more?
They do and they don't. I mean, every business, SME, work very differently that I've experienced. You've got some that are very much, when we talk about entrepreneurial, or let people fly and spread their wings, that they can allow it because they've got that fluidity to be quite organic as well. They might have an end goal, but they know that they don't have to go in a straight line to get there. The other side of it you do get, though, is if someone is an SME and they've been master and commander, for example, but yet they don't want to learn, they find it hard to understand a new technique that comes in from an outside source. So with that, their buy-in as the business leader is a lot harder, because an SME, you know, the risks are greater if something doesn't work out. So with that, sometimes taking that calculated risk, if they don't understand it, is something they're not wanting to bring on board. So sometimes that autonomy isn't there for someone new that comes in.
Yeah, and I think as well, I'm not entirely sure that we legislatively make things very easy. So what I mean by that is, I recently took on a part-time employee, and this person is classed as a young person under the law. And so there are some obligations that I have to meet and some requirements that I have to meet because of that as an employer. But they're not actually, because of the nature of the business I do, the risks are very low. So it's a very easy process. But I could actually imagine that it might actually put companies off a little bit to do that. And also, again, with disabilities as well, that companies might feel a little bit nervous because they don't necessarily understand fully what their obligations are. And so it's this big thing of, well, if I take on somebody with a disability, potentially I'm going to fall foul of the law, and, you know, it's going to be a big problem. So they will do whatever they need to do to almost sort of avoid that thing, when in truth they could be missing out on somebody who will take that business to places it could never imagine it could go.
Absolutely, yeah, and that happens a lot, but that's down to actual awareness of the situation, awareness of the people, awareness of new techniques, new industry methods. And it could be, like I say, if you've always worked in a way that's always worked for you, then that's fine. But as we said, business is changing at an unbelievably fast rate. And so somebody that comes in new, that's hard for someone to maybe input or take him on board. And so when something like that happens, yeah, there are lost opportunities. Absolutely.
Yeah, and it's something that we maybe need to have a little bit more courage with. And again, maybe legislative bodies could invest a little bit more in creating that awareness and making that information more available to people. Again, you know, obviously recruiters and, you know, resourcing companies and consultants are all over that as well. So maybe as SMEs, we should seek a little bit more advice rather than just sitting there frozen with terror. Actually reach out and ask, what are the implications?
Absolutely.
What do I need to do? Because you guys are the experts,
yeah,
right?
The,
you
know, the information's out there, and there are, like I say, industry experts. And, you know, if you go and ask them, they will answer. Like we said before, you know, there's nothing really to hide. There's not a magic formula that should be kept locked away. A lot of it is actually, this is practical sense. This is how it can work. And it works really, you know, there is a psychology element to it, absolutely. But again, that is something that shouldn't be hidden. Actually, people are quite subconsciously aware of it. They've just not got it in their forward conscience. But sometimes, like you say, speaking to an industry expert, they go, oh, do you know what? I knew that all along. I just never really put it into practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Perfect. Okay, so we're recording again. So if any of our listeners have any thoughts on anything that we've discussed so far, please get in touch at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. Andrew, in a recent talk that you gave here at Base Point in Folkestone, you talked about trends in with modern job seekers and the way companies approach recruitment and selection and the way job seekers approach recruitment and selection. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, to give you an overview, I stepped away from what I'd call mainstream recruitment to go do some contract work. And the luxury of that is I had many internal recruiters doing the do for me. When I come back to with Lenartus, I found it fascinating, actually, the psychology now of how people job hunt, but what impact that has on a sort of a social level in terms of like how people do it psychologically, sorry, and how they do that now. It's very much that they use the way of job hunting the same as they would be as an online consumer. And I found because of the use of technology and the use of smartphones that people will engage using smartphone technology and expect the same results as they would if they were buying something online. So with that, it's like, yes, you know, a lot of companies use technology now to recruit, but have they actually really thought about the psychology of what is that person, the job seeker, thinking? What is their mindset of what they feel that transaction should be? And it's very different to what people really assume. So I did a presentation on that basis.
So just to for the benefit of some of our listeners who are maybe like me, children of the 70s and technology isn't our strongest boot. So we're talking here about almost people applying for jobs a bit like they do with online dating, for example. So sort of like swipe right if you're interested, swipe left if you're not.
You could go with that. I mean, the way it looks now with the smartphone technology, what job boards particularly realised was we need this to be very accessible. Now, there's an impression at the moment that there are less skilled people out there, or that there's more skilled jobs, so there's less people, the pool of people is less. They also find that actually, since 2009, speaking of 2019, the amount of vacancies in the UK is reducing. Now, this is problematic. So, especially if you're a job boards, for example, not to say that it's just on them, but why they looked at it was like, we need to give more accessibility. We need it to be more of an ease because, one, people that are paying for job boards or advertising, they will want results. So what are the results? Applications. People that are looking for work, what do they want? They want accessibility to a number of jobs that are available. And this is what smartphone technology has done because every year it's gone up by 10% in terms of people that apply on smartphone rather than your other mediums like using a laptop, for example, or a PC, or even on a newspaper advertisement or the good old-fashioned phone-in or walk-in with a paper-based CV. People will use these online platforms. So using a smartphone is, for most people, is in their hand for at least 6 hours of a day being active. If anything more, over 90%, I believe it's 96% of people own a smartphone. If they have a mobile phone, it's a smartphone device. And so you can understand why that's growing. So what would that mean? Well, in a basic way, is the job boards will look and say, how can we make this as smooth as possible and as quick as possible? So yeah, one of the steps they will use is quick applying. Or you would just type in, for example, say, signalling technician in Dartford area or for Ashford area, and you get a list of jobs within a radius of that. What it also probably is you put under GDPR, obviously, what you allow, maybe email address, as simple as that, as your own sort of signing in sign. What that instantly creates then is they can capture and target you with other options. Have you considered this? Like you kind of do with certain online store cards. If you buy certain goods, suddenly you get an email from that company saying, we saw you bought this the other day. Have you considered this?
People who looked at this product also looked at this product.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly the same process they do with job hunting. So what people will do then is like, oh, okay, they'll look at it, but maybe what they'll do is they'll skim read. So what they'll do, they'll look at the title. If there's a salary or package in there, they'll look at that quickly. They'll probably look at keywords that they recognise in there and then quick apply. So some people, now whether you think this is good or not, may apply for up to 10 jobs within 3 minutes because they can. And that's a big difference. Now, it causes a different problem, but also for the person that's a job hunter, if they do make an application, regardless of the size of the position, they'll expect a response. And the speed of that response is something which employers sometimes are hard to grasp in terms of how quickly they respond to someone that's applying. Because the expectation now of a job hunter is to get a response within 24 hours. If you do 48 hours, that seems a long time now.
Hmm. And in that time, they've lost interest, moved on, etc., etc.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, that is the sort of mantra they'll have now. They would go to the point of, they may have an automated email, perhaps at best, saying, thank you for application, we'll be in touch, if they will be. But they'd still expect the next stage of the process to be within 48 hours. And if they don't have that, they've moved on. Mm. As I say, they could have applied for another dozen jobs in that time.
And just on that, like if you're skim reading and you're looking basically on job title or salary band or whatever, and you get people who've maybe applied for 10 roles in the space of like a couple of minutes when they're on their lunch break or something, like how many of those jobs realistically are those people interested in? And like a follow-up question to that is, how many of these job seekers are bona fide, genuine job seekers?
That's a very good question. I mean, when they looked at statistics of this, they say about 36% are actively looking.
Right, so literally just over a third.
Exactly, ones that are actively looking. Passive job hunters are much higher, near about 49%. Now, passive job hunters, best way to put it, they're actually quite happy where they are, but they're quite interested to see what's out there. So they're not really committal or really actively needing to move, but they will just have a look, and so they'll apply just out of interest. But that 49%, if they find the right job, could be interested to have a discussion. Frighteningly, though, there is the remainder percentage that apply but have got no intention whatsoever. I think they just do it just for the sake of it. I don't know whether that, again, this goes beyond my thinking. Maybe it's a social media phenomenon, how you like things or how you want to associate to be seen that you are active with something. So a lot of people, you know, actually apply for jobs with no intention whatsoever of having ever wanting to go forward with it.
I'll give you a hypothesis on that, because I know somebody, I'm not going to name them, obviously. I know somebody who applied for quite a senior person in an organization, applied for a job at an equivalent level with another organization because he wanted to feel if he was successful with going through the process and getting offered the job. He didn't actually want it, but he needed it as an ego boost. He needed it as a reassurance for himself that actually he was desired, if you like.
Yeah. Well, again, that's a very similar.
That was a very. I can tell you that was a very interesting conversation we had over dinner, because I was like, I had a million questions about what's going on there with your psychology.
Yeah.
That would cause you to do that, but I guess like organizations need to consider that if they've got a number of roles they've got to recruit, and so therefore, you know, you have data sets that say, right, I need to have so many applications to be able to boil it down to this number. Those sort of rogue applicants, if you like, can really skew the numbers a little bit, you know, and could cause you a lot of problems.
And it's becoming more and more relevant. It's happening more. I worked for an organization where I had to get 45 applications to get one person because of the conversion rates that were going on. That was very extreme. But what you have to take in consideration, there is a bit of a science to it, and also a bit of a conversions that you have to go from. Right, how many applications will I need to get to that one ideal person, if it is just for one person? And you have to go with that as well, because realistically, you can actually say, this is how many applications I want. And if you do that, then you will get it. It can be as simplistic as that. You'll have to pay for that to whatever level it will be. But if you get to that level of knowing that I know if I get this amount of applications, I'll get that person, then fantastic. Obviously, there's not an exact science to that.
Yep.
But if you can work to that as a trend, then yeah, you're not going wrong.
Well, I guess it sort of allows you as somebody who's in the nuts and bolts of the day-to-day of getting people engaged into organisations. You need to understand that because you need to understand the level of effort that's required to be able to fulfil an assignment, I guess.
This is it. And on my part, as you could call it, I'm a service provider. You know, people come to me for a service not because they need me to fill that position. As what I've said at the beginning, it's very much about that we're finding someone that's an investment to your business. And by doing that, it is the business transaction shouldn't just be thinking about a recruitment agency to the company. It is actually the company work with a person as also a business meeting or mm-hmm. an investment. Because at the end of the day, as we've talked about, retention, productivity, that person being right for the culture and that workplace is absolute key. So for me to work with that, then the companies need to understand what actually goes on, not just about this is what I want, this is how many people I want to interview, and this is when we'll do it. It's actually understanding, well, is that fit for purpose? And if a company is willing to consult with that, then we can get the happy medium. Sometimes there are where companies do lose out is because it always used to be a feeling that, well, there's more jobs than people. Well, sorry, there's less jobs than people, better way of putting
yes.
it. And so with that, it was actually like, well, you know, they haven't got any other options. So we will put the parameters in. You will come at this date. We'll contact you at this point. You will do this process with us. And then by that point, it might have worked in the past. However, nowadays, if you went with that person, you've lost their engagement and they've gone. But what I will state on all of this is the speed and responsiveness doesn't mean you have to make a decisive measure there and then, but it is about getting the engagement started. That's key. Whether you want them to go through hoops in terms of recruitment process after that, well, if you get them to that stage, it's because you've got that first initial engagement right. And then you can do whatever you wish, whether it's psychometric testing, whether you want them to do any sort of trialing or any sort. That bit is your part of your onboarding, as far as I'm concerned, as much as a recruitment process.
Yeah.
But the real key part is that initial part, which people seem to lose track on, especially businesses, that people don't wait around.
Yeah. Yeah. We're very much a society of we want it and we want it now.
Exactly.
And we're not prepared to wait. And I guess as well, you know, you make that initial engagement back to the applicant. You very quickly then realise whether they're genuinely interested or whether they're just kicking your tyres or whatever.
Exactly. And that is a great barometer to do it by. Yeah, if someone applies, you have the capabilities to apply as soon as you see that application nowadays. And it doesn't take much effort. But by doing that, you're showing a two-way engagement there straight away. If they then respond to that, then you know you've got a true application. Mm. And then with that, you can then start the dialogue. And then you can make that decision, which is the power back in, to make sure, is this the right person to continue this journey with?
Mm-hmm. And I guess as well, sort of maybe a slightly off that track, but still equally important, for organisations for whom their culture is important, and at Leaders and Managers Hub, you know, we hope that culture is important to all organisations. When you engage with a recruiter to go and do that initial recruitment, you need to consider that if you want to portray your organization's culture and its beliefs and core values, you need to work with a recruiter who is able to embody that on your behalf, because potentially they're the first contact that a potential employee has with your organization. And so it shouldn't just be a race to the bottom and all about, you know, cheapest is best. It's about sitting down and understanding the ethics and making sure that the recruitment organization understands your culture and philosophy.
It's absolute key. You know, it's not about how expensive it will be or trying to nail it to the lowest price. It's about value. And I think that's one of the biggest differentiations people don't think of. People believe, you know, I'll say this outright about recruitment, is to get the best value out of recruitment doesn't necessarily mean being the cheapest. If you can be competitive, that's different, but don't take what is the cheapest option. And I think that's one of the big mistakes that actually can happen at times with companies. So the way to look at it is actually, if you are going to be using a recruitment agency, I would say certainly the best thing you need to think of, are they in line with what we are believing? Are they in line with our culture, our beliefs? Are they the ones, because they're going to be spreading the message, looking for those ideal people for us, but do they understand what we are about? They're not going to over egg it. They're not going to like floss over things. They're not going to hide things. They shouldn't. Their transparency is the key. If you get a recruiter that can be as transparent to the people about the businesses that they're representing, you're more on for a winner. It's very much when you get someone that comes in front of you and you think, I had no idea this is what the business was about, you know you're in trouble. Or actually, that wasn't discussed with me. So I also say that that is a two-way thing. So the business needs to be quite open with the recruiters. But to do that, there's got to be a two-way trust.
Yeah. I mean, I've noticed a change in the last, in my industry, probably within the last 5 years. And I believe it's a change for the good, in that when you conduct interviews as the hiring manager, it's now starting to turn into a two-way interview. And I kind of like that. You know, I want people to come into the interview with an expectation and a demand. And I want to make sure that the person that we choose and we hire, you know, is coming to us because they see something in us as an organization that will benefit them as much as we see something in them as an employee that will benefit us. Because for the longer term relationship there, you need to have that two-way thing. And I do think that it's actually a generational thing. Maybe back in my generation, you know, we were encouraged to leave school, get a career, find a partner, buy a house, have children, retire after 40 years with your carriage clock, you know, hunky-dory, great. And I think the younger generations want more than that. And I'm actually quite enthusiastic by that, because what you get with those people as well is if you get the match right, you've potentially got somebody who can grow with your business as far as you can reasonably go. And also you have somebody who has the ability to drive that business as well. And I'm talking about, you know, people who come in at all levels, because if you recruit into any particular level in your organization, and you're not thinking of them in terms of, A, how can this person drive our growth and how can they grow with us, you're kind of missing a trick a little bit. Now, I know that's not always easy to do, because, you know, sometimes it's more about volume. And we've talked off air about, you know, some of the industries where it's all about numbers, and it's sort of like a transient workforce or whatever. Yeah. But if you want to make a real investment in your organization, and people are your single biggest investment, and you have a proper sustainability plan, growth plan, resilience plan, you need to make sure the people you're engaging fit into that.
Absolutely.
And that suits them as well. Otherwise, it's going to be an unhappy marriage and it's not going to last long.
Exactly. And the way it is seen now very much is it's not a would-be job seeker going to an interview to see an employer, a would-be employer. It is like a two-way business discussion now, because, you know, I use it as a corny start at the beginning, where I say, you know, the most valuable asset in any business is the people within it. You know, they can be the most unpredictable, but they are the most valuable. They are, regardless of the amount of technology you might have and processes you will have, you'll still need the right people to run it and drive it. And that's what people know nowadays, is they know that actually I will go there to make sure it's right for me as much as it's a job to get. And that's really how it's very different. And businesses that are very on board with that are the ones that do thrive. They're the ones that actually are very successful now, because they realise now, you know, we talk about a younger generation now, there is this sort of a, you could say, a generalistic view that they want things so much quicker and they want things so much easier. The first part I agree with. They do want things quicker, but they'll work just as hard.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference now, is actually speed of progress, speed of movement is much more what happens in today's society. So people would naturally expect that with business and work.
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think we can generalize about these things. No. But my experience of any generation, if you get proper engagement, two-way engagement in an employer-employee relationship, like the output will be so much more. With machines and technology, yes, we always make sort of step change improvements, but with your human resources, there's no end to where they can go.
Exactly. If you get buy-in, which is the ultimate, you know, we talk about business leaders and we talk about them being the visionary, and you talk about them having what their, I guess you could say, their generals pushing that vision and making it work. But those generals would need to get buy-in from the soldiers to say, oh, I understand how that works. It becomes their own belief as well. That's how it can work. And it has to work in a business culture more so, rather than do this, do as I say. It doesn't work, because if they're not actually engaged or actually understand why, you don't get the right productivity.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we learned this in the construction industry when we, from a health and safety perspective. So over the decades, we, you know, developed and refined systems and processes, safe systems of work, et cetera, et cetera. But we were still killing people at an extreme rate relative to other sectors. And so we started to look at the psychology of people at work and behavioral safety. And we realized that actually it is about engagement, that you can have any amount of process and any amount of procedure, but at the end of the day, you're relying on people to actually follow those and go above and beyond and use their initiative and do all the things that humans can do that currently machines can't. Now, let's not get into a conversation about AI, but, you know, at the end of the day, humans are adaptable, you know, they're flexible, they can understand, they can assimilate information, they can transform. So we want to encourage that. We don't just want to create human robots. Yeah. And I think organizations need to consider that. Plus as well, you need leaders at every level of your organization to drive success. The most successful sports teams are teams that have leaders all over the field, as they say. We got leaders all over the pitch. They don't just rely on the coaches and the manager. And so organizations need to think a little bit like that as well. And that's one of the things we're kind of pretty passionate about at Leaders and Managers Hub.
Absolutely, I can see that. And what I'd say is, you know, for companies, if there's something I'd say, what could they do differently to what they do as a norm now? It would certainly be is look at what your recruitment process now, and does it actually think about the person rather than the actual process of hiring? Does it, you know, what are you taking into consideration of, like, when that person applies for your job, are you considering what their next expectation will be? And I think that's something to always really consider when you do your own recruitment, is you've got to look at that and think, right, I'm putting an ad on, or I'm actually putting a poster up on a Telegraph poll, whatever way you want to do it, and you get applications that come in, how are you going to react to that? How are you going to engage? Because that will be the key to your success right at the beginning part.
Wonderful. Andrew, it's been great.
Pleasure. Thank you.
How can our listeners get in touch with you?
So I would say, like, well, I wouldn't say is an old school way, but you can just get in touch with us. Best way for me is my email address, I'd always recommend. So it's andrew@lunatusresourcing.com. Our website is www.lunatus.co.uk. But the best form of communication.
Okay. And also, if listeners want to, they can email us at podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. And if in the subject line they put a reference to Andrew, we'll make sure that correspondence gets to Andrew. And one of the things I was discussing with Andrew earlier off air was the possibility that if, you know, we get some good feedback That we may even in the not too distant future dedicate a whole show to issues around recruitment, selection, onboarding, etc. So any questions you have, any interesting feedback you've got, any interesting experiences you've had, anything you want to challenge us on anything that you've heard in this cast, please get in touch, podcast@leadersandmanagershub.com. It's just so incredible, gotta have it. Can't let it go. If you don't try, you'll never know.